Many Seventh-day Adventists today are doctors, nurses, dietitians, and physical therapists, working in hospitals, sanitariums, and health food stores on every continent. But it wasn't always so. To understand the critical need for improved medical practices, we must go back to 1799, to Mount Vernon, Virginia, where the young nation's greatest hero lay dying.
The patient doesn't improve, gentlemen. The third bleeding accomplished no more than the other two, even though we took another 32 ounces of poisoned blood from his veins.
The application of blisters hasn't helped either, nor have the doses of calomel.
Let's try some more emetic tartar.
Yes, and another inhalation of vinegar and water vapor.
Please.
He's trying to speak. Yes, sir. What are you trying to say?
Please, let me die without further interruption.
Details of this treatment were published to assure the people that their beloved former president had received the best care possible. Over the next half century, there was little improvement. There were no antibiotics. Doctors dosed their patients with poisons such as arsenic, strychnine, opium, and calomel, which were called drugs. And they frequently prescribed tobacco to strengthen weak lungs. Gradually, some physicians began to experiment with natural remedies. A Dr. Jackson and a Dr. Trawl operated water cure institutions. In the winter of 1862-1863, James and Ellen White had a first-hand experience with water treatments. Diphtheria was raging, and two of their sons came down with sore throats and fever.
One doctor recommends a poultice of Spanish flies and turpentine. Should we try that, James?
I haven't noticed that it's helped any other children. Wait a minute. I saw an article in one of the New York papers by Dr. J.C. Jackson. He said he regularly cures diphtheria with water treatments. I'll go find it.
Do you suppose that's enough water, James?
Yes. Dr. Jackson said to use just enough hot water to make a sitz bath and a basin of warm water on the floor for the patient to put his feet in.
All right, Willie. You're first.
Yes, Mother.
Sit down carefully, son.
Now, we wrap the heavy blanket around him to keep the heat in. And a cold towel rolled into a band around his head. There.
I look like an Indian.
You sound more like a wheelbarrow load of gravel. Here, let me reach under the blanket and rub the hot water over your chest.
Step by step, James and Ellen followed Dr. Jackson's instructions. To their joy, both boys recovered completely, and Ellen successfully used the same treatment a few days later on Elder Moses Hull's oldest child. In September 1864, James and Ellen visited Dr. Jackson's institute, Our Home on the Hillside, to observe his methods.
I'm very impressed with Dr. Jackson's methods, James. They're very close to what I was shown in vision. A vegetarian diet, two meals a day, no drugs. But I just can't approve of the amusements provided.
For the object for which they're intended, and when confined to the institution, they don't seem so objectionable, but I fear the influence of card playing and dancing upon young men and women when they leave the institution.
A year later, they returned to the institute, this time as patients. James, who had overworked in spite of the instruction received in 1863, had suffered a severe stroke, and Ellen was exhausted from caring for him. They stayed for 3 months. En route home, Ellen had a vision in Rochester, New York, on Christmas Day, 1865. She presented the message of this vision at the General Conference session of May, 1866.
The health reform is part of the third angel's message and is just as closely connected with it as are the arm and hand with the human body. Our people should have an institution of their own, under their own control, for the benefit of the diseased and suffering among us. As unbelievers shall resort to an institution conducted by Sabbath-keeping physicians, they will be brought directly under the influence of the truth.
Brother Loughborough, come in.
Brother Kellogg, you heard the testimony that Sister White read to us. A few of us have decided to make an investment for the purpose presented, sink or swim. We thought we'd like to have your name at the head of the list, as you have more money than any of us.
Let me take that paper. J.P. Kellogg, $500. There it is, sink or swim.
Others quickly added their names to the subscription list, and the committee sold shares for $25 each, with the promise of dividends. Before long, however, on Ellen White's counsel, the investors donated their shares to the Institute. The 9-acre residence of Judge Graves was purchased, and on September 5, 1866, the Western Health Reform Institute was opened with two physicians, two helpers, and one patient. By January 1867, however, the Institute was running out of room for patients.
Listen to this, Libby. According to this article reprinted in the Review, Indians are gathering more war parties out west. They claim the government's broken its promises, that they're going to die anyway, and they'd rather die fighting than starve on the reservation.
That's disgraceful, Horace. Why can't the government provide proper food for the Indians who have surrendered?
Because people want to see the Indians exterminated, that's why. To make more room for settlers. Oh, there's something by Dr. Lay about the Health Institute. We do not dare to advertise the institution to any great extent, for fear we shall not have place for those that may wish to come.
My, it sounds as though the Health Institute is doing very well.
Too well. Dr. Lay says he needs $25,000 to put up another building. He says here, we can take care of at least 100 more patients than we now have.
I suppose we should contribute then. After all, Sister White said in Testimony 11 that we should support the Health Institute.
Yes, I'm sure she knows about it. They get the Review up there in Greenville.
James, this is one of the heaviest trials I've ever borne. In spite of my conversations with the directors of the Health Institute and my letters to them, they're determined to erect this new building.
I wish I were well enough to go to Battle Creek myself. They're pushing expansion too fast. You saw in your vision that the Institute should start small and grow gradually. They haven't listened.
And now they're using my testimony that asks people to support the building of the Institute to urge people to support this expansion. I should never have let Uriah Smith press me into publishing a plea for support of the Health Institute before I had time to write the entire vision. That will never happen again.
Even John Loughborough and John Andrews are supporting the expansion.
I saw that the health work is to be an arm of the message, not the whole message. Funds which should be spent on evangelism are going to the Institute.
Not only that, but people who can't really afford it are being pressured to give more.
Plans went forward over the next months. Materials were bought and the foundation was dug. On September 9th, 1867, Ellen and James, accompanied by John Loughborough, traveled by carriage to Battle Creek, where Ellen addressed the church on Sabbath.
And as I have seen the large calculations hastily urged, I have felt alarmed. Should the physicians fail, through sickness, death, or any other cause, the work would be hindered. Should means fail to come in when extensive buildings were in process of erection, capital would be sunk. Also, there might be a lack of patients to occupy present accommodations, Consequently, a lack of means to meet expenses.
I hadn't thought of that.
What she says makes sense.
I thought the expansion was going too fast.
With all the efforts in every department put forth, and with the blessing of God, the institution will prove a glorious success, while a single failure might prove a great injury. It should not be forgotten that out of many hygienic institutions started within the last 25 years, but few maintain even a visible existence at the present time. Move no faster, brethren, than the unmistakable providence of God opens the way.
Brother White, we want to ask you to serve on the board of directors of the Health Institute. You're the only one with business experience, and we need you to guide us.
I'll be glad to do all I can to help. The large building is given up for the present, and the material is being sold. Still, a debt of several thousand dollars will be resting upon the Institute.
What's going to happen to the ones who caused this trouble?
They should be censured.
Those who have committed errors for want of experience feel all they should, and it is not Christian-like to murmur against them. Now, we have plans that will make it possible to continue the activities of the Institute within its resources. Fear not, the business is sound.
It was not yet smooth sailing for the Health Institute. In 1868, the Institute was found to be in debt $13,000, mostly because so many of the patients were needy church members who were charged only half rates. It was at this time that the dividend-paying stocks were abandoned and the Institute was run as a non-profit concern. By 1870, James was able to get a new board installed, this time consisting of experienced businessmen. The Institute rallied, and on July 21st, 1871, 800 guests from the church, institute, and city celebrated its success with a service of rededication and a gala picnic.